This episode of Bun in the Oven is sponsored by The Bump Plan. Given the theme of this podcast, I imagine that some of you are currently pregnant or planning a family. So many women I know just aren't sure how to move their body safely during this changing time. Or they want to stay active but need someone to show them the way and hold their hand. That's where The Bump Plan comes in. The Bump Plan is a holistic prenatal fitness plan that allows you to work out with confidence at each trimester of your pregnancy. Founded by myself, Holly Grant, the Bump Plan has already helped over 10,000 pregnant women stay active safely and feel empowered throughout their pregnancies. Through its trimester-specific workouts, in which I'm always at the same stage of my pregnancy as you will be in yours, hypnobirthing subscription and extensive education hub, you'll feel supported and part of a welcome community. Let me help you move safely through your pregnancy, maintain your fitness and strength, and enter parenthood strong and prepared for all the demands it poses. As a listener of Bun in the Oven, I'm offering you £5 per month off the cost of your monthly subscription to the Bump Plan, simply by entering the code BUN at checkout. To get started today, simply head to pilatespt.co.uk/the-bump-plan and enter the code BUN at checkout. That's B-U-N in lowercase to get £5 off the monthly cost of the Bump Plan. Join our community today and stay strong throughout your pregnancy. Man meets woman, man marries woman, man has sex with woman, woman gets pregnant. This is the story we so often hear about how children are made, but this is just not the reality for everyone. My name's Holly Grant. I'm the founder of The Bump Plan and you're listening to Bun in the Oven, a podcast that explores the myriad of challenges and routes to becoming and being a parent. For the last 11 years, I've worked across the globe as a Pilates instructor and advanced pre- and postnatal fitness specialist. During that time, I've worked with thousands of people, have heard hundreds of stories about fertility, infertility, pregnancy, and parenthood, and have learned so much about the often rocky road to becoming a parent, which I find fascinating. Bun in the Oven will dive into the many different ways children are brought into this world and what parenting really involves. I hope you find this podcast a huge source of support and that it helps open all our minds. In this week's episode, we'll be talking about the experience of being pregnant with twins or multiples. My guests are fitness expert and twin mum Britt Williams and birth and postpartum doula Lala Langtree White.
So it becomes a very anxious pregnancy, and I think it's one where it can feel very isolating because, I mean, I barely knew anyone who was having their second baby, let alone their third and the fourth, let alone twins that people were, you know, you were constantly being told to kind of just manage your expectations, prepare yourself for the worst, that sort of mentality, which is really taxing on your mental health through a pregnancy when you're perhaps struggling with the physical symptoms of it as well.
Britt Williams is a personal trainer, women's fitness expert, published fitness author, business owner, and mum to three young kids, including twins. Britt has 13 years combined experience in the wellness industry, but becoming a mum in 2018 cemented her appreciation for the role movement plays in empowering modern women to embody their strongest selves. She went on to publish her first book in 2019, signing her book deal for Mind Body Bump, The Complete Plan for an Active Pregnancy, just days before the birth of her first daughter, and is a strong advocate for exercise during pregnancy. Our second guest is Lala Langtree White, a birth and postpartum doula, antenatal and hypnobirthing coach, and breastfeeding and baby-wearing counsellor, alongside being a mother to four children, including a set of complex, monozygotic, identical twins. Following her own experience of twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, Lala's desire to ensure others never feel as isolated and emotionally unsupported as she did during this challenging time led her organically to Small and Mighty Babies, a voluntary support community and not-for-profit organisation she co-facilitates for families navigating high-risk pregnancy and babies born preterm or poorly. In this episode, Lala and Britt share the emotional challenges that can come with the initial realisation you're pregnant with multiples, the numerous, often well-meaning, comments from strangers around multiple pregnancies, and the high-risk diagnosis and care you then receive. I love the honesty both women have around the shock and awe of multiple pregnancies that then turns into the absolute joy of having them earthside.
Thank you. Hi, Britt and Lala. Thank you so much for being on today's podcast.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, you're welcome. And you guys are both in Dubai at the moment, aren't you?
We are.
Yeah. This is the benefit of Zoom. Literally before lockdown happened, I'd never even heard of Zoom. So thank you, Zoom. It saved all of us. But thank you both for being on today's podcast. As I've already mentioned in the introduction, we're going to be talking about what it's really like to be pregnant with multiples, so twins, triplets, and so forth. But more from a human side of things. We've been talking off camera about the fact that, you know, when you're pregnant with twins, obviously there's a lot more medical intervention needed and medical support. But actually, let's really think today about how it feels to be pregnant with twins and then to have two or three babies at the end of that pregnancy. So, spoiler alert, Britt has had twins. So, Britt, give us a little bit more information about you and your family at home.
Well, as it stands, I have three children. Just recently bypassed three under three. My eldest turned three in January. So when we found out that we were pregnant with, well, we planned to be pregnant and we thought we'll just miss the two under two mark and, you know, every sanity will be relatively maintained in the household. And then we learned that it was spontaneous identical twins or non-fraternal twins. And yeah, we learned that we then have three under three. So it was definitely an unanticipated pregnancy in that regard. But yet the girls now, the twins are now 14 months. So we have three girls and each of them are very different, unique characters, despite two of them being technically identical.
So Lala, you could probably tell us a little bit more about this because I only found out, I would say a year or so ago, about how twins actually come about. And actually when you learn the science behind it and actually what's gone on, you realize that it is an absolute miracle. Getting pregnant with one baby is a miracle, but with two, it just blows my mind. So can you give us the kind of science behind it?
It's absolutely amazing. And I think it's one of those things, there's still a lot of myths around, but in a kind of really simplified version, you've got twins or multiples happen in two ways. One is because you ovulate or you transfer, if you're going through assisted reproductive technology, more than one embryo or more than one egg that is then fertilized. Okay, so which is where you often see, you know, people saying, do twins run in your family? Because you are somebody who hyperovulates, so you ovulate more than one egg at a time. And that could be, obviously, that could be three eggs and you could have triplets. But, you know, if you ovulate two at a time, and this is where they sometimes say, oh, and it skips a generation, because obviously you can, as a woman, carry that gene and you can hyperovulate, but if you have sons, they can pass that gene down to their daughter. Does that make sense in terms of the genetics of that? Again, there might be some geneticists listening going, she's absolute, you know, this is rubbish, but this is as I understand it from what I teach as well. And then you have got the wonder of monozygotic twins, where you ovulate one egg that then splits up after fertilization. And in a bit of a nutshell, in a really simplified version, if that splitting is really efficient and happens around day one to three, you're going to end up with two placentas, two amniotic sacs. So they can appear like same-sex fraternal twins. And there used to be a lot of a myth, kind of, you know, even still a lot of doctors these days, if they see two placentas, they'll straight away say you're having fraternal twins. But actually, if they're same sex, that's not the case. They could be monozygotic and that splitting was really efficient. And then if they split day three to six, you're going to look at one placenta and two amniotic sacs. Six to nine, one placenta and one amniotic sac. And then beyond that, you know, obviously you've got, you know, conjoined twins. So it's rarer the further you go along. Okay, so most have either separate placentas and separate amniotic sacs, or commonly they have one placenta and two amniotic sacs, which is what both my twins and Britt's twins had.
And the reason I stumbled around that language, you might have heard me, I said identical, then I kind of corrected myself because it's not the strictly scientific identification of that kind of pregnancy. And what my confusion was for the first half of my pregnancy, I was told I was definitely having fraternal twins. So two placentas, two amniotic sacs, so it would have come from a hyperovulation. And my husband and I were like, there's no twins in our family. And certainly that can happen spontaneously. It was just a question in our minds that it had been such a big surprise, given there was, you know, no history that we could trace. And then halfway through, our midwife, we were still in the UK at this stage, at the 20 week point, we were going to find out about gender, which, you know, had it been a straightforward pregnancy, a single pregnancy, we probably wouldn't have, because we did with our first. We thought, oh, the surprise would be nice. But this was surprise enough. So we were excited to find out about gender. We learned it's two girls. And then I'm looking at the scan and I'm going, oh yeah, but they look really different. And the midwife is kind of going, they don't really, actually. She did a little more digging, and then she said, oh, I think we can only see one placenta here. So I was misdiagnosed with the type of pregnancy that I had, which is why I always kind of stumble around that identical fraternal language, because it was a stumbling point through the whole of my pregnancy.
So they were from the same egg then that split?
From the same egg. So they're identical girls. So they have to be from the same egg. But like Lala said, had they split earlier, I could then have the two placentas, two amniotic sacs. So I did have two amniotic sacs, but just that shared placenta.
That is just firstly so confusing, isn't it? Just as a listener, but also just incredible that there are so many potential journeys and so many potential different options. I think for me, it just blows my mind, you know, given how long, it took us a little while to get pregnant. And I realize how incredible it is for just one egg to meet one sperm. But the thought of two eggs just happening to be released at the same time, that both then just happen to get fertilized, it's all incredible. But I would imagine it's also quite a shock.
At that stage, to be identified as what you would call a two placenta, two amniotic sac pregnancy is DCDA. And that's your most straightforward. So in the UK, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Lala, in the UK, you can still be referred for vaginal delivery if everything goes well. Is that correct?
You have your prenatal care. So the NICE guidelines around your care requirements is different if you are having a dichorionic diamniotic pregnancy versus if you're having a monochorionic diamniotic pregnancy, because the sharing of that placenta is a bit like, there's a great analogy of, it's a bit like sharing the plumbing in one house, and somebody can be sealing all the hot water and someone's just getting all the cold. And basically, if they have this uneven, so identical, spontaneous identical twins is, or monozygotic, I try to say, and that's a little bit the language of twin parents, in that trying to give them their own identity. So rather than saying identical, which kind of lumps them in together, trying to say monozygotic, you started as one egg, but the second that egg splits, you've got differentiation. You've got, you know, what share of placenta they get, how they, where they implant, what their life in utero is like. You've got differentiation right from the beginning. But that placenta, that shared placenta, does have ramifications, because if they share in about 10 to 15% of pregnancies, monochorionic pregnancies, they don't share that evenly. And that's when it can lead to something called twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, which, left untreated or undiagnosed, is catastrophic for pregnancies. So that's why that proper diagnosis early on is so vital.
Yeah, so it was a little bit scary for me, because I got that diagnosis at the 20-week point. Wow. So at that stage, I hadn't had the higher level of monitoring that I would have had I been correctly identified as monochorionic diamniotic in the first place.
And you guys have just given the perfect example of how medicalized it instantly becomes as soon as there is more than one baby. The language you guys are using, the different options, the different diagnosis, just shows that it does become much more medical than if you were just having a single pregnancy, right?
Yeah, very much so. So once I knew I was moving out here, which we didn't know until very late in the game, I moved out when I was 28 weeks pregnant. And it was quite a late stage to transfer your care, because at that stage, you are more likely to go into spontaneous labor earlier, or more likely to need a much more invasive form of monitoring, or a much more frequent monitoring. So I got the sign off from the doctors, but it was kind of up in the air whether that was going to happen, all tied up with this relocation to Dubai and then transferring my care from the national system in the UK over to a private system over here. So that's when I reached out to Lala, and she very much helped me to navigate the system here, signposted me to the right doctors who had the skill and experience, but also maybe a softer bedside manner or a softer more open-minded approach to what that labor could look like.
And because you'd already had a baby before, you'd had an insight into kind of how frequently you see your midwife and your doctor when you're pregnant with just a single baby. And I, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think when it's your first, you already see them, a midwife and doctor, a little bit more than you would with a subsequent pregnancy. But it's not all that often. I remember every time I saw my midwife, she'd be like, oh yeah, I'll see you in like 6 weeks or something. And I used to think, gosh, that's a long time before I see her again. So then all of a sudden, when you're pregnant with twins, that does change a lot, doesn't it? And you would have been able to compare the difference between how much you see your midwife or doctor with a single pregnancy. Lala, can you talk us through what it is like from a how often you're seeing your midwife when you've got a twin pregnancy?
Absolutely. And this will vary a little bit from country to country, region to region. But the NICE guidelines lay this out really, really well. And if you are having a monochorionic pregnancy, so again, that's the word for that shared placenta, then you need to be seen from the 16 week up to about, I think it's 26 weeks, you need to be seen every 2 weeks. I will clarify this and we can put the links for the NICE guidelines in here afterwards for anyone listening. But you need to be seen every 2 weeks. Whereas at that stage, if you were having dichorionic, you would be seen every 4 weeks. So it's important because often with twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, there are sometimes no external symptoms at all. So for me, I was diagnosed at 13 weeks. I just got to that 12-week mark where you stopped panicking so much. I was very, very worried about miscarriage in the first trimester. And then obviously we announced our pregnancy to everybody. And then literally the week later, I'd gone to the 12-week scan. They said, oh, I can't see all the measurements. Can you just pop back next week? Which I did. And then they said, I'm sorry to say that you're stage 2 with twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome. And then our journey began from there. But that is why it's so important to be seen every couple of weeks. So as Britt was saying, she felt a bit anxious that at 20 weeks, she'd kind of missed a couple of appointments. Luckily, at that stage, then she hopped straight back onto the monitoring in terms of a monochorionic pregnancy. But the other thing that you see as well is you're going to see much more obstetric-led care than you are midwifery-led care. Mm-hmm. Within certain units in the UK, I think there's more of a combination. There's more a kind of a multi-skilled approach as well, so that you do see the midwife. Because I think as women, as mum, I think some of the things you'll say to your midwife, you perhaps wouldn't necessarily bring up with your obstetrician. You know, there are certain things that you feel more comfortable or within that space or within the kind of care practice that midwives bring. We're doing this just after the International Day of the Midwife, so we can big shout out to all those amazing midwives. But it makes a big difference, I think, to the care. And you're scanned so much more frequently. So it's not just those appointments with checking in, you know, maybe the urine test, blood pressure, etc. It's such frequent scanning as well. So I think you sometimes can feel, and obviously if you do have a complication like I did with the twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, you're then seen all the more frequently again. I think there was one point where I was being seen, you know, 2 or 3 times a week. And you're being scanned so regularly, you feel a little bit like a walking incubator. You know, twin one, twin two, twin A, twin B. It's very, very, it feels quite detached, I think.
Yeah.
And that's before they introduce the cervical scanning, if you have a doctor who's inclined to monitor that, which I did. So they're often concerned about kind of premature cervical ripening. I'm not sure I'm using the right language, Lala, you can correct me. Yeah, so your cervix becomes weaker and shorter, which is basically a sign that you're approaching labor, but that can happen much earlier just because of mostly because of the weight of your uterus, right? So that got picked up, I think I was about 32 weeks here, and you can have stitching. There's different things that you can do to try to address that, but basically they're going to be internally scanning you. So as if you were having an early scan, you know, sometimes you have an internal scan to see the baby before 8 weeks, I think it is. It's the same kind of thing. So it becomes that much more invasive. It's not just your typical ultrasounds.
Gosh, so it's just highly medicalized, even when things are going right, even when there isn't anything wrong. Because I'm guessing, my understanding then is that Brit, in general, things were kind of ticking along, but you had the difficulties of changing location and the fact that, you know, you had a misdiagnosis and at 20 weeks you suddenly had more information. But Lala, I'm presuming that obviously you've had twins as well, and that there was a potential issue happening that then made it even more medical.
Absolutely. And I think what you touched on at the beginning, you know, at the time, again, Britt and I, our stories weren't massively dissimilar in that I had only moved to, I hadn't been in Dubai yet 6 months before I was pregnant with the twins. And it was a surprise, spontaneous third pregnancy. So I had a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old at the time. And, you know, and again, with twins, you have an increased chance of having things like, you know, severe nausea and morning sickness or hyperemesis gravidarum in its extremities, you know, the fatigue, the all the common pregnancy symptoms, you have an increased chance of experiencing. And partly that is just because of the weight and pressure and toll on your body in carrying twins. So there's that in the very normal pregnancy, there's still a lot of extra factors, I think, that perhaps aren't always as empathetically understood outside of the multiple birth culture if you haven't experienced it yourself, because it's very difficult to. I'd had a girl and a boy. I was like, I've got this parenting thing down. I know what I'm doing. And then, you know, the universe thought, well, watch this. I'm going to give you twins. You know nothing. But yes, it was, you know, when I then had that diagnosis, yes, it became much more complex. And it was tricky. It was spending that pregnancy feeling, you know, my twins, so twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, left untreated has about a 90% fatality rate. And so it really is a very nasty condition to have. And it requires surgery it's called laser ablation surgery, to go in and separate basically the blood vessels, find out which blood vessels are shared and be able to separate them by cauterizing them so that both babies come away with an equal share of blood volume. And there's about a 60% chance that one baby will survive the surgery, a 30% chance that both will, and then obviously about a 30% chance that you'll lose both babies. So it's a very, very, very worrying time. And I think the longest reported death after surgery was about 6 weeks later. So even once you've had it and the scan looks good, the anxiety lingers for a long, long time. And it, you go on to have from having a surgery, an increased chance of having other complexities. Obviously, you've then had surgery laparoscopically in the uterus, so therefore you have an increased chance of having the babies more prematurely. So it becomes a very anxious pregnancy. And I think it's one where it can feel very isolating because, I mean, I barely knew anyone who was having their second baby, let alone their third and the fourth, let alone twins or twins that people were, you know, you were constantly being told to kind of just manage your expectations, prepare yourself for the worst, that sort of mentality, which is really taxing on your mental health through a pregnancy when you're perhaps struggling with the physical symptoms of it as well. It can be quite relentless. And so a massive part of what I do now is creating a space for those families, for anyone having a different pregnancy, basically, is what we do.
Well, we talked last night, I talked to someone called Ilian Morrison, who is a midwife, but also a hypnobirthing teacher, and she does a lot of birth debriefs, so independent ones, you know, rather than going back to the hospital where it all happened. And she mentioned something that I'd never really thought about, and she'd said often we think about birth trauma as being purely about birth, so about the labor. So if someone's had a really stressful labor, we'll think, oh, well, they're probably going to have birth trauma, or that's the person most likely to have it. But we forget that actually lots of people can suffer postnatally because of their pregnancy. They might have a really lovely labor or everything might go to plan during labor, but actually suffer because their pregnancy was really stressful or they had really strong symptoms. And actually the thought of being pregnant again is actually really quite scary for them. I can't imagine, from what you guys have both said about being pregnant with twins, that sounds like a really tough pregnancy mentally.
I think it really can be. It can be a beautiful pregnancy too. It really can. And I wouldn't ever want anyone to feel like it's a, you know, you're stuck with that high risk label and you're basically a ticking time bomb waiting for something to go wrong, waiting for a complication. And I think you can often feel that a little bit with twins. Britt, did you feel that much, given that you'd had a single baby before, and when you found out that you were then having monochorionic twins, was that something you felt?
I think, yeah, the joy of pregnancy felt a little bit robbed from me at that stage. But that said, I was pretty comfortable all the way through until about 32 weeks. I didn't feel that different from a single pregnancy. And I mean, it hadn't been that long before. I had a two-year-old at the time, a little less than a two-year-old at that time. So it's not that it was a distant memory. Maybe, you know, I tried to stay present with what I was feeling in my body at any given day. And certainly I had more and faster growth, but my body was pretty adept at dealing with that. And I think I had even more respect for the female body as a result. So I think there was kind of that joy and that kind of like, wow, I'm growing two babies, and the community off the back of that too. I started to develop, I knew I was moving. So it was hard to kind of reach out, you know, to a community that I knew I could really connect with in the long term in the UK. I did join with Twin Trust at the time. I think its name has since changed, and spoke to a couple of twin mums who'd been through it and had some insights to share. And it really is a really welcoming community. Like I feel like even now, if I'm out with the twins and you see another twin mum, I feel like you see it more just you really do. There's like a call of arms. And then certainly once I moved out here as well. So although you don't necessarily feel the support within or that emotional support within the medical world, it is there. You just need to look for it.
That's really helpful. So if anyone that's watching, listening to this, who is pregnant with multiples, there are support networks out there. How would you find them? Would you Google them? Facebook?
Yeah, they're quite accessible. So in the UK, Twins Trust is the big one. You've got iCombo as well. They're everywhere, basically in Australia, in America, like anywhere you go, there is a multiples community. But the Twins Trust in the UK is a really strong one. Here in Dubai, we have Twins Plus Arabia, which I'm very proud to be a part of and help admin and run that community out here. And it's fantastic. There is a kind of sisterhood in it that you don't see to the same extent when you have one baby. When you had twins or triplets, there's a real like, you know this. I see you. And it's really lovely. And it's very, I mean, that's what gets you through it as well. That is what gets you through it for sure. I joined a couple of coffee mornings when I was pregnant, and they were my absolute lifeline. So it was never even an intention that I would do the things I do now. It just was this organic rolling snowball that just grew into this huge avalanche of kind of, right, well, that's what I'm doing now, clearly. And I love it. And I really, really love working with my twin and triplet families. And in fact, the first time I ever doulaed for anybody was with a set of triplets, so I went straight in at the deep end.
That's really great advice, guys, because I wouldn't have known that there were support groups out there. And it makes sense, you know, those who need the most support often have the most support. It's just accessing it. Britt, one thing I would like to talk to you about is obviously you work in fitness. You know, when I first met you, you were working at Sweaty Betty. You're one of the fittest people that I know. You're also an instructor yourself, fitness expert, and you were really active during your first pregnancy, weren't you? As soon as, you know, the words kind of high risk or contraindications come into play, that does affect whether we can exercise during pregnancy. So talk us through your experience with fitness kind of first compared to second time around.
So I was, during my first pregnancy, I was in the process of talking to my publishers about the book that I hadn't yet signed, but would come to be after my daughter was born. So I was already kind of building this ethos and programming around pregnancy, and it was absolutely integrated in my own experience as well, and the experience I had with my clients. So you know, you couldn't have found a fiercer advocate for moving during pregnancy. And then with the twin pregnancy, you know, it is a relative contraindication according to NICE guidelines. So because I had that misdiagnosed DCDA pregnancy, that kind of easier going twin pregnancy to begin with, I just carried on as usual. I actually did cross-reference back to my book. It was kind of nice to be able to then engage with people who were doing the program. But with the MCDA, I probably scaled back on impact a little bit more than I would have, or a little earlier than I did in that first pregnancy. Just being aware of the added complications and not wanting to eat the one placenta, you know, that's all tied up in blood flow and how you're feeding these two humans. So I kind of felt like I didn't want to get that heart rate too high, and you know, whether there's any real scientific justification in that, it was a real emotional and mental kind of barrier to me. So I just tempered everything back a little bit. You know, and that's there's not a whole great deal of science dedicated to this population because it's a small population and because there's ethical implications to testing that population, you know, pregnancy single or multiple or otherwise. But yeah, so I think, you know, there's good work being done there that is reassuring to moms who are in the know and are making sure that they have the latest information and are working with experts and professionals who do, you know, can signpost that information. Like just last year, the University of Alberta, they have the exercise pregnancy research team and they just updated. So I think they removed a DCDA twin pregnancy from relative contraindications. So there is more work being done there to empower women to move. Once I moved out here, my doctor here was definitely very conservative, wasn't so happy with the level of exercise I had been doing. And I kind of, you know, nudge, wink, wink, yeah, I'll ease up. And I did ease up on the actual, you know, workout front, but I had just moved country. I was setting up a home that was going to, you know, keep, nurture and entertain and house my, well, nearly three-year-old at the time and these two new little ones, and there was so much to do. So just my daily life was already really active. So to say, you know, try to put your feet up for 80% of the day was pretty unrealistic. So I think the exercise that I did do, I was just mindful to try to counteract some of that daily activity, which was already probably more elevated than I would have ideally had. So it was kind of, it was more down training and restorative exercise. So it still played a role, but it was just different. It was at a lower energy level, a lower output level, and just a little more mindful. But it definitely still was, you know, it held my hand through the whole way and made me feel like myself within a process where you do just kind of become this medical entity.
Yeah. And touching on exercising during pregnancy, you know, the difficulty is that, you know, it is a bit of a gray area. And you also notice there's quite a lot of difference between what one doctor might say compared to what one midwife might say compared to a fitness professional. You know, there's not a huge amount of clarity. So it leaves women feeling, you know, confused, understandably anxious. You know, for a lot of women, they were trying for a baby, and so when a baby's there, it's so precious to them, and they don't want to do anything that could risk harming them. But then with that comes a lot of actually you know, misinformation and rumors. Exercising during pregnancy is really, really beneficial and advised by the Department of Health. But then we do then have, you know, a list of contraindications in the background there to protect everybody. And they're either relative, which means that you probably can still exercise, but we might just need to think about a few changes and how that's going to look. And then absolute contraindications, which in theory mean no, sadly, you cannot exercise during pregnancy. But as you've mentioned, Britt, you know, it's not always clear cut. It would be really unethical to take a lot of pregnant women and make them do something and see what the ramifications were. So, you know, we're not always 100% sure if something that's a relative contraindication actually is a risk and that exercise could cause harm, because it could just be that something that was going to happen anyway. So it is a gray area. So I would always just say, definitely refer to those contraindications, speak to your midwife, speak to your doctor, try to get a few different opinions. Like you said, Britt, you know, as soon as you moved out there, they were very like, no, actually, we don't want you to do this. But you do also have to think about yourself here, because exercise might be a huge part of your mental health care. And you need to get through this and you need to come out the other side still knowing who you are. So I definitely wouldn't just stop what you're doing straight away. I would definitely get opinions and get advice on that, because exercise is mentally beneficial and physically beneficial.
I think especially if you've been recommended bed rest, that's something that doctors can get a little trigger happy with. So just being prepared to, and that's something I really learned, it's not second guessing your doctor or you know, undervaluing their opinions, but just having your own opinions and challenging them or asking for the context around certain decisions that are being made on your behalf. Just to take one quite extreme example, which Lala has, you know, sadly personal experience in and works with plenty of families surrounding TTS. I was very, very strongly recommended for cesarean delivery because of the risk of TTS specifically during labor. And I could not get. I kept trying to get, well, what's the evidence for that? Give me some numbers. When did you last see it? And it was just always very vague, or we kind of move on to another topic quite quickly. I couldn't get an answer. And Lala kindly signposted me to another doctor in the area who has more experience in that. And there actually is zero evidence. There are no reported cases. I don't know if that's still the case, but at that stage last year, there were no reported cases of acute TTS happening during a labor. So I was being told that absolutely you cannot have a vaginal labor because of this. You know, I guess it's a high risk in the fact in the sense that it could be fatal if it were to happen, but there's no example of it. So you need to balance, like with all risks, you need to balance, you know, the ramifications with the likelihood of it happening. So I didn't feel like I got a fair balance on that in that regard.
Mm. And that's something that's talked about a lot in hypnobirthing, isn't it? You know, being able to ask, you know, what are the alternatives? What are the risks? What are the reasons? You know, and making sure that you have all the information and that it essentially does come down to your choice, but it's an informed choice,
yeah,
which we don't always get. You know, sometimes we're just talked to like we're children and we just do what we're told.
Yeah, but you can push back. And I, you know, just because you're met with, you know, silence or dismissal at first, that's not your stopping point. That's if anything, that probably means that they don't really have the answer. So maybe dig a little deeper.
So we've talked a lot about kind of what the pregnancy looks like medically and the fact that it then does become very medical. How does it feel emotionally to be pregnant with twins, knowing that you're going to be quite drastically increasing the size of your family, that you will need two of everything, that things are going to be different? How does that feel emotionally?
It was definitely scary. I mean, I cried at the ultrasound, sobbed probably harder than I've ever sobbed. And I've yet to speak to anybody. I do speak to people who say, oh, I'd love to have twins, but I think that's in theory. Not that they wouldn't love to in practice either, but when it actually dawns on you that you're about to enter and go down this journey, it is a real shock and awe experience. So I've yet to speak to anybody who's been part of that big reveal, who's been ecstatic about it. Lala, I mean, you love little ones, so maybe you were. Were you the exception?
No, I was. It was a surprise pregnancy, and I went to have a scan. And, you know, again, this is one of the things Britt has actually helped me, which has contributed to a book for healthcare professionals all around multiple pregnancies with Cambridge University Press, or in the process of doing so. You know, one of the things was, you know, that sonographer, how you deliver that news, that obstetrician, whoever you are, is really, you need to meet the parents at the level that they're at. And I was obviously lying on the table. As you said, it was the transvaginal ultrasound that you had. And, you know, she just asked me some routine questions. How many children do you have? How old are you? Do you have twins in the family? And she stopped there. And then I said, is that just a routine question? She flipped the screen around. She was like, no, there are two. And I was beyond shocked. I think I burst out into the waiting room and told everyone. I just shouted at them as twins. You know, it's a massive, massive shock. And what that's going to mean, I think, particularly if you then have two other children or other children, what's that going to mean for them? You feel a little bit like their babyhood's going to be robbed. What's this pregnancy going to look like? How's my health going to be? Because when you have another baby, you start to obviously your own well-being becomes a much bigger factor. That am I going to be okay for my other children? So, I mean, I think that complexity of emotion has an ability to kind of snowball and run away. And this is where connecting with a community of other people who can empathize with what you've been through and share a bit of their experience is just essential, absolutely essential. And I think one of the things, touching on what you were saying earlier about exercise and things like that, is that's a really good time to look internally. I think when we start to have a twin pregnancy and we look so much to that external support in terms of the medical care, I think we can unintentionally undermine our own intuition as well and our instincts, which, as we know, as a hypnobirthing teacher and likewise, you know, is huge. Like, we have to foster and nurture those parenting instincts right from the get-go, because there is some stuff that you just can't really quantify or rationalize. You just feel, you know, what's right for you or what's right for your babies. And I think that is something that's really big, and especially around listening to your body, around where exercise sits for you and what it does for you and what your body's feeling, and as that adapts as you go further along in your pregnancy.
You know, exercise for me was, it's always been part of my identity, you know, as a mother and as just a woman. But during the twin pregnancy, it was not just for me. It wasn't selfish. It was also an opportunity to, I mean, I know, you know, the countless benefits of an active pregnancy. So for myself and for my babies, yes, you know, those physical benefits were on my mind, but it was a chance to bond with them. I was moving with them. And that was a part of the emotional experience. When everything else was, you know, maybe a little more out of my control, I could control that. And like you do, if you listen in, you do get feedback. If something doesn't feel right, then pull away from that. But the stuff that feels good, like, work with that. And that's a chance for, you're moving with your babies. Like it was, yeah, it became quite emotional for me. I'd always have a little bit of time to connect before a workout and a little bit of time to kind of absorb it all after. And I'd sometimes get a little teary eyed because that was my time just to be with them.
I often talk about how in studio, when I first start training a new client, I often ask them to give me a number between 1 and 10. How are you feeling? How hard is this on a scale of 1 to 10? 10 being this is very hard. And often they will really, really struggle with this. So they'll just be like, oh, I don't know. And I'm like, well, give me a number. I don't know, it's hard, but can you put a number to that? And the reason I find it so difficult is we're so used to just watching our apps on our watch or looking at our phone to get step counts, and like everything else tells us how we're feeling, but actually who better to tell you how you're feeling than yourself? So I feel like we can be really disconnected from the head and the body, and we just don't know how to tell people how we feel. And then they do get better at that. Pregnant women, I find, are much better at that because they're so used to checking in with how they're feeling. How am I feeling today? Have I felt my baby move? You know, oh God, am I feeling nauseous? Is the baby coming? We're much better at knowing how our body feels. And so that's why I think that exercising during pregnancy is actually, like you've said, Britt, a really great way to just check in with how you're feeling and listen to your body. And does this feel okay? For me, running didn't feel okay, but then lots of other things did. So I think it's a great time to listen to your body. And as you've said, what a great way to bond with your baby and have time just with the babies, you know, with your other children, hopefully in childcare.
I think it can be a lot harder. That's one of the things I would say that I have noticed as somebody who specializes in supporting parents of multiples, is I think it's a lot harder in a multiple pregnancy to connect in, because I think you look externally so much more for reassurance. You know, you look for those next scans to know that everything's okay, because again, sometimes differentiating where your babies are and what they are doing is different. I mean, I don't even remember one of my first and now I can say very irrational thoughts, but at the time it was a huge thing, was, hold on, am I going to be the same to them as I am to my other two? Because they have each other. They knew about each other before I even knew about them. So am I the lemon in this relationship? You know, it was thoughts like that, that I thought, well, where do I fit in this? You know, strange things. And I think, you know, if you then particularly, if you look at taking a family who've gone through perhaps a long fertility assisted journey, and then to go into a complex high risk multiple pregnancy, potentially with an NICU journey at the end of that, you've unintentionally undermined or kind of put very much on the back burner the parent's intuition at every step of that. Perhaps rightly so, because that level of medical assistance and support has been really warranted and really needed. But this is where co-decision making and really engaging with parents and how they're feeling and what they think, and so that they really understand all the decisions, is so key. And then particularly in NICU, involving them in their care with their baby, because otherwise, you know, you've got all of this, you go from one to the other of these highly medicalized situations, and then it's, you go home and, you know, work with all those parenting instincts and raise those babies. And we see, again, there's not as much research as we'd like, but we do see that there is an increased chance of perinatal mental health disorders around multiple pregnancy, around premature birth, and just the intensity of having two small babies, the lack of sleep, the exhaustion in just caring for two babies is so amplified that it is, you know, it's very hard to then find time to actually even reach out for support, even if it is accessible. So I think this is where you then find that by not having that connection with yourself or that link to your intuition perhaps throughout your pregnancy, it can do us a disservice, I think, afterwards as well. It can be really, really hard. And I think that's something that I'd love to see more rebalanced.
You are managing so many external factors when you're pregnant with twins that you don't have that lovely, I mean, it's not always lovely, it can be anxiety inducing time as well. But when you're pregnant with one, certainly my first, I had all this time to read about what it was going to be like to be a mum, what I was going to need on a day-to-day basis. How do you pack a nappy bag? All these, you know, basics. And you don't, when you're pregnant with multiples, you're contending with, the facts in front of you on a changing weekly basis. Like you're always absorbed by that. So you don't have that much time for future planning. So I can definitely empathize and relate to what Lala was saying, in that I didn't really consider what it was going to be like to especially having another one on, you know, in tow the whole time. I didn't have time. So yeah, you take these two home and it is, there is nothing like it. It is the biggest shell shock.
And we're going to touch on that in a moment, actually. But yeah, I think the way you guys are kind of describing it is, it's almost like the babies are talked about as just like you said, like baby A and baby B. And they're just talked about as things, you know, that you guys are trying to protect and keep alive, you know, and hopefully bring into the world, that then actually when they do arrive, that's must be almost just a bit of a shock. One question before we move on to talking about things like labour, is that you've both been really honest in saying that at the scan you were both shocked, and actually it not necessarily being like, oh my gosh, yay, we're pregnant with twins. It was more of a, oh my gosh, we're pregnant with twins. Did you find that quite hard to admit at the time? Or is that something of that you still find uncomfortable to admit? Or actually now you've found the community, do you feel quite comfortable saying, you know, it's not necessarily what I wanted planned, but now they're here, of course I love them?
I think at the time you maybe feel a little bit uncomfortable admitting that. Like I had my sonographer when I first found out was, you know, oh, what a blessing, and that kind of language is a real disconnect with how you're feeling and what people are telling you. So to come to terms with that was a challenge. But once you have reached out, and like I say, I haven't yet spoken to a single other mum of multiples who said, oh, that was just the most joyous moment of my life, then you realize how normal it is. So like all these things, I think the more you talk about it and the more you hear those shared experiences, the less kind of taboo it feels.
I think the general feeling of overwhelm, and in fact, I think my emotions changed so rapidly in the space of a sentence that I almost couldn't kind of work out exactly what I was feeling. And I always say to mums, like, you will find often that you're flitting between different things, because as soon as I kind of got over the overwhelm of the shock of finding out, obviously I went down the Google rabbit hole, because that's what we do, even though we know it's not helpful, and worked out, you know, and found out how high the rate of, the relative rate of miscarriage was for monochorionic twins. So then I became, you know, incredibly guilty that I'd felt that I'd felt anything other than ecstatic to begin with. And I felt very, very worried that, you know, I'd caused some kind of superstitious, you know, all the things that you know not to be the case, but it was a really complex time. And I think because as soon as you share that with everyone, it tends to be the reactions are either, oh, rather you than me, kind of, you know, double trouble. Oh, Hugh, we've dodged a bullet here. Or it tends to be like, oh, matching outfits, it's so cute, can't wait. And you're not really, neither one of those are particularly helpful. You're not here yet, and you certainly don't want to hear double trouble, because I think that it's not helpful, and it's really dismisses how, yes, we have got unique challenges to being a parent of multiples, but the joys are every bit as unique and incredible as well. So, but I do still say to my husband all the time, I really don't see you as a dad of twins. He's like, you know, they're six next week, don't you? Like, I have been parenting twins for 6 years now. I'm like, yes, I just don't see it. It just blows my mind that you have twins.
It must just become the norm for you guys. But thinking about what you just said, Lala, you know, I was thinking before this recording this podcast, I was quite a big, I was quite big while I was pregnant. So I got lots of the type of comments like, are you sure there's not twins in there? And I'd be like, oh God, I hope not. And actually, when I was thinking about this podcast, I was thinking that's actually really offensive. And that's actually, it's a really common phrase, but actually it's not a very nice phrase, is it? Because actually, like you've said, you know, having twins is a joy, and lots of you guys do have twins, but it's just such a flippant comment that I don't think we think about, but it is a very common comment, isn't it?
Absolutely. And if you've got a mum who's already anxious about how she's going to cope and what this is going to look like, particularly if it was perhaps an unplanned pregnancy, to go straight in with the, you know, supposedly humorous and somewhat heartwarming, oh, double trouble, you know, it's not setting a very supportive tone, I think, to her as well. And I think it's something that, again, is really kind of perpetuated out there. I mean, you think of the media when you see twins, it's all, you know, they're always kind of mischievous and it's always naughty, they're up to escapades, you know. And I'm not saying that it's a walk in the park parenting twins, and it's, you know, but my gosh, it's an absolute privilege I wouldn't swap for the world.
Oh, that's so lovely to hear. So then let's talk about labour then, because if pregnancy is much more medicalised, then I'm presuming that labour is going to be the same.
In 2019, there was a great update to the NICE guidelines, which was really good. Been a long time coming. It was fantastic. And so at the moment, the recommendation is that unless there are any fetal or maternal factors that obviously are an additional influencing factor around any mode of birth, you know, such as preeclampsia or anything else that's going on, then if mum has reached 32 weeks gestation, there's no significant size discordance between the babies, so not more than about 20% usually, and the first baby is head down, then women should be supported and understand their options between having a cesarean birth or having trying for a vaginal birth as well. I think that there is still a very big bias towards cesarean birth being sort of billed as the safer of the two. And I think that it's very, very hard to, you know, little words are put in there to kind of coerce and perhaps kind of sway mum's decisions a little bit. But I would love women to be more aware of what the guidelines are and be able to make those decisions or be very involved in those decisions, feel confident to take an active role in what feels right for them. If you have monochorionic twins, so those ones that share the placenta, then it's recommended that you are offered, and again, offered being a key word rather than forced, offered to have elective birth from 36 weeks. So that would be either by induction of labor or by cesarean. And then all you have expectant management would be your other choice. And then if it's dichorionic twins, that is recommended from 37 weeks. Obviously with triplets, it's slightly earlier. And even with twins, in about 60% of twins come spontaneously before 37 weeks. So again, you know, what you're going to plan for it. And with twins, I think it's one where you definitely need to have your kind of plan A, plan B, plan C as well.
What's the reason why they are, why do we choose for them to be born 36 weeks earlier?
With monochorionic twins, there is an increased chance of fetal mortality beyond the 36th week, and with dichorionic twins beyond 37th week. So in the same way that with a singleton pregnancy, I believe that is at beyond 42 weeks. So it's just relative to the type of pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I guess my thoughts on it were that a lot of multiple pregnancies would then basically just booked in for a cesarean. And my understanding of the reasoning is that when it comes to cesareans, you know, the risks, it's all very structured. You know, they know the chances of this happening and this happening. Everything is planned and everything's prepared. Whereas as soon as we start thinking about having a vaginal birth, you know, there's things can change and it's not as easily managed, and doctors like to know the numbers, they like to know the risks and all of that lot. So I presume that's why they might often sway somebody towards a cesarean.
I think, you know, again, it would be unfair of me to speculate on what an individual doctor's reasonings might be, but I think you have to, you know, we all have to empathize with the fact that we have quite an overstretched maternity system. There is a convenience for everyone within cesarean birth, but I think, you know, and I think sometimes there can be less value than is deserving placed on maternal satisfaction around birth as well. And, you know, I think that's a really undervalued weigh-in on that decision as well. And I think Britt would probably be she'd be the perfect person to talk about that, really, because that was very much your experience, I think, wasn't it?
Britt, mm-hmm. I'm intrigued. Tell me what happened.
So, I mean, I have a completely, well, I guess it's not a rational surgery, it's scary, right? But I have a long-standing phobia of surgery. So to me, I know some women are terrified of a vaginal delivery. I'm the opposite. I feel like that is, there's elements of that I can control, whereas me being kind of dictated to during a delivery felt very, very uncomfortable. So as Lala saw, she saw me a couple of weeks before I delivered. We were going through kind of birth plan, and I think I had never really even visualized what a cesarean birth could look like because I was so resistant to it happening. So I said to Lala, just talk me through like what would happen step by step. And I couldn't, and I'm a pretty emotionally resolute person. I can normally stomach most things. I just couldn't. I was just a mess. So it's a really, really entrenched fear. So, you know, bearing that in mind, if everything's going well, and absolutely, if there are contraindications to that, then you have to listen to that. But if everything's going well and it's recommended or permitted within the NICE guidelines, then a doctor should entertain that. So I fortunately did find a doctor who would entertain a vaginal delivery. His threshold for intervention was quite low, and he was persistent in reminding me of that. But I was very lucky. So they suspected a little bit of growth restriction happening towards the 36-week mark. So he decided I wasn't going to, in some cases, I'll let you go a little bit over if you want to, and if you're prepared to be monitored more. So he wanted to induce me on my 36-week. And so I found that out about 4 days before, and my mother-in-law was coming like the same day. So I was like, oh, thank God. So we had somebody at home with my eldest. But at the same time, the relief that we were going to have somebody to support us, but then also the fear of, gosh, this is actually happening. And then kind of fortunately, because I like spontaneity. I like to feel like it was destined to be rather than scheduled to be. So the Friday before, I just seen you, Lala, in the daytime, actually did a little last minute review. And so the Friday night, I kind of felt they weren't contractions, but they were like really strong Braxtons. And just a few signs. I thought in the morning, maybe I'd lost my plug. Things looked a little bit different down there. And I was just like, maybe this is like a really long, because my first labor was what they call a precipitous delivery. So it was very, very quick. So I was a little bit slower to dilate, but initially, and then once I hit like 7, I was off and away to push phase within minutes. So we kind of suspected that would be the case. And with twins as well, they're smaller, things are going to move faster. So they didn't really want me to go into a spontaneous labor because there was a good chance I'd have them on my bathroom floor. So I called the doctor and he said, well, come on in. And I called Lala, she came on in. And I walked into the labor ward and the midwives are ready to strap me up, get me undressed, like, we're having these babies, let's go. And I was like, oh, wait, I thought we were being assessed. Like, what's going on? So I was like, can we just take a step back and take a breath? And so they were monitoring fetal heart rates, and doctor was coming and was ready to induce. And then, you know, he checked my cervix and I wasn't quite as far along as they thought I was. So they're like, well, you do have the choice to go home. But once again, you know, if you're having some signs of an early labor, maybe reconsider that. So I said, okay, we're going to do this, because, you know, there are some early signs. So I feel like, you know, it's a little mix of destiny and convenience. And then, so I had a bacterial strain, so I needed to be on an antibiotic drip an hour before I was induced. So that happened at 11:45. At 12:45, they came and broke my waters, which my eldest was born in her waters. So I'd never experienced that. Kind of interesting. I feel like I've got the kind of trifectorate of birth experiences now. And it was rapid. I think the first 20 minutes or so, it was manageable. Lala had done a lovely meditation, so I was kind of in a good headspace. And then the true induction contraction started, and they were just as my first labor had been, because it was that fast towards the end, but it was just like that. So really intense, not much time to catch your breath in between. And because I had to be bed bound, because they want to monitor both the heart rates, so they need you in a relatively stationary position. So I didn't have that kind of relief of mobility that I'd had with my first. So I had a wonderful midwife. And this is something I would say too, for women who are having a little more intervention during a natural labor, is feel free to cherry pick your team a little bit if you can. So I don't know if you're always assigned a single midwife, but there were two midwives on duty who were kind of circulating, one I really connected with and one I really didn't. I think Lala did help me to make that quite clear as well. So we got the one that I connected with on board, and she would allow me to roll onto my side. We had a tactical pee break because I think baby's head wasn't coming down right where we needed it to be to push, but she was right there. So Lala suggested I get up and wee. And I remember standing over the toilet and being like, Lala, I can't, I don't know how, because I just had kind of like disconnected with the sensation. And then I kind of just relaxed, reconnected. And as soon as I got back on the bed, it was time to push. So it was actually just my husband, Lala, the midwife, and me for the first baby. The doctor missed the first birth. They called him and he came rushing, but he missed it. And then, so she was born. She was born on my side. I was allowed to deliver her on my side because the doctor wasn't there. He was determined I'd be in stirrups. So I delivered her on the side, and then I had 6 minutes with her on my chest. And then baby two was ready to go. And by then the doctor was in and was in the stirrups, but I was so adamant. I said, well, I'll use the stirrups, but I'm using them to push. I won't be passive. I did just that. I was like in a glute bridge and I delivered her, and they were both actually spine to spine, which traditionally could be a little more painful, but it was okay because they were quite small. So wow. Yeah, it was a really happy birth story. After kind of all of that, I was really relieved that I'd had some control. I'd had a voice in that experience.
Oh my gosh, that's incredible. And, you know, maybe some people listening to this haven't really heard of doulas before or don't really know what they do. I mean, I'm still relatively new to it. Lala, what's your role in a birth like that?
So as a doula, we are there for informational support, helping you find evidence-based information and being responsible for staying up to date with new information as well, to be able to signpost you so you don't go down the Google rabbit hole, so we can kind of streamline you to some really good resources. We are there for emotional support, so a huge part of preparing you emotionally for what labor looks like, what that transition to parenting can look like, what breastfeeding a baby looks like, and also physically in terms of comfort. So comfort management with natural measures during labor, during your recovery and well-being, and into that adjustment to life as new parents or parents of more than one baby if it's your second or third as well. So I typically do a couple of two or three prenatal sessions with clients, then labor, and we're on call for you 24 hours a day. And then we're there to kind of be at the end of the phone and come and be with you whenever you need us for that extra level of support during your labor and birth. And we usually stay until your baby's born and that first feed has been established. And then a couple of postpartum sessions at home as well. Most of my clients become great friends and I've been in touch with them years later. What each family needs is very individual. We adapt to them. And there's a different doula for each person, you know. So, you know, the people who I resonate with may not be the people, you know, there'd be different doulas for everyone. It's always worth meeting a couple of people. And it is something that, you know, I couldn't in a million of years have imagined doing, and I can't imagine doing anything else now. I love what I do. And when you get to support someone like Brit in a birth like hers, where you know how much she's had to advocate for herself as well, and to see it going, you know, it's incredible. It's so powerful and it's so beautiful. And again, I really want to say that, you know, advocate is not the same as, you know, I don't think there's any parent who wants to go into this being antagonistic. You know, you're going into it, you're not looking for confrontation or for conflict. You are wanting to do the best for your babies. No one ever, ever, ever wants to jeopardize their health or that of their babies. But I think it's so important that, you know, maternal instincts and maternal satisfaction and wishes and desires and preferences around birth are also respected within that context of a safe and a healthy mum and baby, massively.
And I guess you're there to help with that. You know, you get to know the mother and their wishes and their concerns. And then you also know the medical side of things as well. And you're able to then be that bridge between what the mother wants, but also what the medical team want.
Absolutely.
And Lala, you never spoke for me. You were just a sounding board. And that's what was really nice. So like it was always my voice that I was using. It was never somebody like, it wasn't even just sometimes it was an echo and sometimes it was just an alternative insight, something to think about, someone to put you in a calmer headspace so you were making yourself clearer. You know, that can feel like quite a panicked time, especially as you're getting close to delivery. So just to bring you back to the ground and feel like you're speaking from, you know, a solid foundation. So that was really useful. And also just to mention that the fact that, you know, husbands have higher anxiety in that process as well. So, you know, there's the logistics, first baby's born and then husband might go off with first baby while they're doing all the birth checks, and you still want somebody there with you for baby number two. There might be that logistic, or maybe they're getting rushed off to NICU. You know, fortunately that didn't, I was able to be with mine a little bit, but that's very common. So to have, I wanted that reassurance that I was going to have somebody with me at all times, and I didn't want, you know, my babies not to have somebody with them if that were the case. So so that was really fantastic. And, you know, all of the wonderful things that UK midwives do, it's not as commonly practiced out here. The midwives maybe aren't quite as hands-on. It is more obstetric led. So that kind of hands-on lumbar support, which I personally love in labor, that was, you know, Lala knew exactly the right spots to push, to counter push, to give a little bit of relief throughout. So I didn't have time for epidural, even if I'd elected to, because it was so fast. So I definitely needed, you know, that constant reassurance physically and within your ear and just emotionally.
Yeah, we're definitely never there to replace birth partners, but we're there to kind of work together as a team. And I think mum feeling that kind of little bubble of security and safety and love and well-being is so beneficial however you're giving birth. And, you know, I do specialize a lot in supporting mums with twins and triplets, and I think something about it is you kind of know a little bit of that journey yourself, but also that, you know, as Britt said, there are so many variables when it comes to having multiples. When are they going to arrive? Is one of the babies going to get me to go to NICU? Are both babies going to go to NICU? Am I going to be on my own without my husband and my babies, or my birth partner, I should say, and my babies, because they've gone to NICU together? What's that going to look like? Who's going to be supporting me? How does this work? And obviously, you know, again, it's needless to say, within the last year of the global pandemic, again, birth support has looked different all over again. So hopefully we're seeing a reemergence to a bit of more normality and a bit more choice for women around the support that's right for them.
It must just be so fantastic having more than one birth partner there, but also bridging that gap between not just being emotionally invested, like your partner, your birth partner might be, but also knowing what's going on behind the scenes. So then I guess we should probably finish with talking about what it's like to bring twins home. There's two of them, you need two of everything, there's only one of you, both of you, what is that like?
We started out with a fairly long and bumpy NICU ride to begin with ours. So for me, that was the real challenge for me, and that was not having my babies with me. And then equally having two relative babies, you know, at home and feeling really torn between everyone. And, you know, and again, within the hospital that I was in, my babies initially were in two separate units. They both had different levels of dependency of care needs. And there wasn't a lot of collaborating between the teams. So one baby needed to be expressed for every 2 hours and attended to every 2 hours. One was every three, which meant I was doing it every hour. And then every fourth hour, I'd get a break to go and rest, take my medication, anything else. And this was after an emergency cesarean. So it was just, I mean, I remember after the end of that first week where I did nothing but literally, I think, walk the halls and cry. I was expressing everything from every angle that wasn't leaking something. And I just, you know, I remember saying to my husband, I don't care what marathon I run or mountain I climb, nothing will ever touch the sides on how tough this is. It was extraordinary. And it felt so isolating. And I only, you know, I didn't want to speak to other families who just walked out the front door of the hospital with their healthy baby. I wanted to speak to another family who had done this. And at that, I wanted to speak to a family who'd sat, you know, a mum who'd sat next to one incubator, pumping and holding that baby, feeling guilty that they weren't sitting next to another. And all that goes on in NICU, you know, I had a day very early on. The first time I ever got to hold one of my babies was the day that the baby in the incubator next to me very, very devastatingly passed away. So that first experience of holding my baby will forever be marred by that feeling of how flipping lucky we were and how desperate, you know, this journey is for so many people as well. So it was just so intense on so many levels. Both of mine required little surgeries, and things that, you know, within the NICU world are fairly routine, but for you as a parent, you know, this is, it's huge. It's absolutely huge. So again, today, you know, if anyone ever asks why I do any of the things that I do, I can give you a million reasons, because it's that support is just so needed. And as you said, you know, there are so many opportunities for trauma, because when you're in it, you don't get to press pause, you know, but that can come out years later, months later, when you finally get to go, wait, I've got half a minute to myself. Oh my word. How do we get here? We survived it. We're okay. Everyone's, how did this happen? Or we didn't. You know, again, one of the things we see a lot is obviously babies who, you know, maybe only one twin came home, and you're caring for a baby whilst also trying to care for that grief. And that is just, there are so many additional layers of complexity and challenge and joy and triumph around multiples as well.
At that time where you're sort of walking around the hospital and just feeling incredibly overwhelmed, I guess you can't imagine ever feeling normal again. You can't ever imagine life being normal again and you feeling like you again. But, you know, looking at you now and speaking to you now, you do get through it and things do change and you do get into a routine. Do you have any advice for those women who maybe are still in the really early stages that are just feeling a bit shell-shocked?
Definitely reach out, connect with other mums. That is the biggest thing, understanding that you're not alone in feeling this way and there are no wrong emotions. Everything you're feeling is 100% valid. Caring for yourself, understanding, I think managing your expectations around what those early weeks look like is really important, so that you kind of understand what an NICU journey might look like or what going home with your babies might look like. Because even babies who are born at 37 weeks, considered full term, the average birth weight for a twin at 37 weeks is about 2.5 kg. So you're right on that low birth weight margin as well, which brings some complexities in itself in terms of feeding and those sorts of things. You know, you've got quite sleepy babies, they're going to be more prone to jaundice, those sorts of things. So there's lots of additional factors that you just really perhaps didn't take into account. You know, again, shameless plug aside, you know, I've trained like you in hypnobirthing and childbirth education. And I felt when I had my twins, I was like, none of them even touched the sides when it came to preparing mums for multiples. I really didn't feel it. Everything was a little bit of a caveat, or we were an addendum to this, or this is everyone else, but this is you guys, you know, this is not gonna happen for you. So I actually went and wrote a couple of books on my own antenatal course specifically for twins, triplets and more, because it was so needed.
And we'll share that in the show notes as well, because that is going to be just vital information for so many parents. Britt, how about you? How was it bringing the babies home?
So we had a short NICU stay. We were there for 3 days, and it was just, so we went in and there was kind of these whispers of COVID-19 and what was coming to the world. So it was mid-March, my babies were born. And then over the stay, all of these kind of lockdown measures, they were quite quick to lock down in Dubai, were being enforced. So I had my first night, my husband and me were there. I was breastfeeding again, they weren't on the same schedule. I was up and down breastfeeding. Fortunately, they both latched. So I did have to do some pumping back in the room just to get my supply up, but I was able to be with them for those feeds. Because for me, having had pretty straightforward pregnancy before and being with my baby immediately, having a night in hospital and going home, it felt really scary being a part of just brought these two people into the world, and now I have to spend the majority of my time away from them. So having that skin to skin and contact with them was my lifeline. But then I think on the second day, my mother-in-law came in, and Marnie, my eldest, came in, and we were really excited to show them the twins. And no, nobody in NICU except for the parents. And even then, actually, parents were supposed to come in at particular times, but they made an exception because mine were feeding. So you kind of then, you're just contending with all of this, and then that's a separate conversation in itself. But and I think, you know, all parents, pregnant, new parents altogether are, you know, have had a very unique experience with regards to the pandemic. So that's aside from that. But I think, you know, kind of I was feeling that isolation and then layer that on top. It was quite a lot to cope with. But it was just mostly size that they needed to, they needed to put on a little bit more weight before they could go home. So once they'd done that, we could go home. But they were teeny tiny, like they were, so it was 1.9 kilos and 2.2 kilos. And you know, their little legs, they were little chicken legs, there was nothing on them. So yes, my mother-in-law got to meet them, which was really lovely. She's still the only family member who's met them. But she didn't really want to cuddle them because they just felt so fragile. So it's not this kind of lovely, welcoming home that you might imagine. And I think, yeah, preparing for that, preparing for kind of sleepy feeds. They do sleep so much. They are, you know, they're basically still like an extension of in utero. They sleep and eat. So preparing for that, just lots of kind of low-key time at home, not really going anywhere. You know, within, I think with my firstborn, we were in Starbucks after day three, just because I wanted to get out and see the world again. That wasn't possible. So I needed to kind of realign my expectations with reality. And then it does, it just, you know, every day, every week gets a little bit easier. There's feeding complications. One of ours was slower to put on weight. So, you know, you have to keep reaching out for support when you need it. And that support, you can't always anticipate what support you're going to need. Having somebody like Lala, who has your breastfeeding counselor yourself, Lala, so being able to signpost to different people was really helpful. There's an amazing, I think it was a Medela component called a feeding tube. So you would literally feed them from your fingertip. And I'd never heard anything of it, like absolutely no idea. But I had Lala signposted me to another kind of like a home midwife support unit. And I had somebody come in and train myself and my husband how to do that to top up their feeds. And, you know, there is a lot to learn. The learning curve is really, really steep, but you don't need to climb it yourself. Mm-hmm. So yeah, just bearing in mind that, you know, expect the unexpected and get the support you need when you tackle that next, when you come to that next hill, next mountain.
Guys, that's been so, so interesting and so insightful. Thank you so much for all of the information that you have given. I do have just a couple of last few questions that came in from people that listen to the podcast and know about the podcast. So kind of quick fire round, if that's possible, before we sign off. To both of you, what is the best thing about having twins?
Watching them interact. I mean, honestly, it's like living in a Discovery Channel program every day. They're in different classes at school. And when I pick them up, there are two solid hours where there's no point in me even trying to get into conversation with one of them because they are in another world. And they orbit around each other in a way that is just, having worked so hard to get them into this world, I can't take my eyes off them. 6 years later, every day I have a pinch me moment that, oh my gosh, I have twins and it's phenomenal.
That's gorgeous. Britt?
Same. It started around 5 months. They recognized each other. From 8 months, they were playing, and now they are inseparable. They have their own in jokes, and they still speak baby language. So I'm not in on them, but I hope to be one day.
That must be so interesting to watch. The best purchase. So someone who's pregnant with twins right now, what do they need to buy?
What was my best purchase? A really good twin breastfeeding pillow to begin with, and a really good double breast pump. Those things to begin with are the things that were fundamental to my breastfeeding journey. So those were really, really big for me.
Mm-hmm. And Brett?
I would second that. And then some good, some versatile baby wearing options as well, especially if you have other children, because that was really tough. It was a really big adjustment for my eldest. And she was, if anything, she got the most of my attention. I was feeding.
They were the
easiest to kind of leave with somebody else if need be, and to give her that one-to-one time, or if I was with them, because I was feeding so much, I wanted to have them on my body, but still be able to give her the time of day. So have a single carrier, have a good double carrier, just really good versatile options so that you can strap on one or two whenever you need to.
And then finally, what one piece of advice or what one thing would you go back and say to, you know, pregnant Brit or pregnant Lala, or to someone listening to this who is pregnant, what would that one piece of advice be for them right now?
I mean, I'd love to go back to pregnant Lala and say, you'll get through this. Mm-hmm. It's going to be okay. So just try and enjoy this pregnancy a bit. And I would also say to, you know, breastfeeding Lala in the trenches of parenting Lala, you know, enjoy it. Like, just take the small moments here. I think one of the things that's easy to forget is even when a baby is born at 36 weeks, there's a big difference between a 40-weeker and a 36-weeker. And then you're waiting. If you think about that first smile you get typically around 6 weeks, your baby's born that bit earlier, you might be waiting 10 weeks for that first give back. And that's a lot of take without getting that, oh my gosh, look at you, mummy, you're amazing smile. So just, you know what, like, just celebrate those small moments and know that you're doing amazing, you're doing your best, and your best is just brilliant. So just remind yourself of that.
I echo all of that. And just that you will have the happiest times of your life as a result of this as well. I think it all feels very worrying and overwhelming, but there is so much happiness as well. And I always say now, people say, oh, you got your hands full, or people walk past and say, yeah, double trouble, or all these kind of throwaway phrases, and don't look at you, don't you have your hands full? And I always kind of say, yeah, you should see my heart.
Oh, that's so lovely, guys. That's been so fascinating. And I've loved how you have shown the other side of it, you know, to the unknown, you know, to anyone else, there are those comments, but actually it's a double joy rather than double trouble. And I'm sure that this will be so helpful for anyone who is pregnant right now with twins or in those early stages. So ladies, thank you so much for all of your insight.
Thank you for having us.
Firstly, I want to say a huge thank you to my guests today for being so open and honest about personal topics on such a public platform. That takes real bravery and will help so many others. I genuinely believe that one person's honesty can help free many. If you found today's episode helpful, please do head to the show notes to find links and support our guests feel may be useful. Secondly, this podcast can only help those who know about it. If you enjoyed this podcast, it would mean so much to me if you could rate us with a 5-star rating and leave us a review, or hit follow to be the first to hear when our next episode lands. While podcasts are easy to listen to, they take a lot of effort to create, and your support in sharing Bun in the Oven will help me encourage more guests to join me for future episodes. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and enjoy the rest of your day.